Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Constructive Criticism. I'm your host, Spencer, and I'm joined by my co-host, a silver pro looking for platinum? Question mark? Michael Hinderocker.
I mean, I appreciate that. I think everyone is always looking for platinum. It just seems like a good, you know, sort of ongoing goal. I don't really have a good plan, but I'd take it if it fell in my lap.
I don't even know that's just true magic. Like, if you just found platinum on the ground, your life is pretty good, right? You just go sell that.
Is platinum valuable?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, if I find platinum on my lap, or if I, you know, casually win a pro tour, then, you know, I'll take it.
It's like the same thing, right? It's...
It depends on how much platinum you find, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, you know what's funny? I have to tell this story. So Devonair, I was explaining pro points to Devonair, because she was like, we were talking about Grand Prix, and like, that I was going with you guys, and like, she's like, well, what do pro points get you? Because you, like, get one at, like, every tournament you go to, but you don't do anything with them. Like, Michael's silver, and Matt's, like, apparently bronze, but what are you? I was like, well, Devonair, I'm like, Mason likes to call me a wood-level pro. I've got, like, 4 pro points this season, so nothing. It's because we were talking about the Hall of Fame vote, and I was like, I need 150 pro points to get that one day. It's like, it is like my magic goal. And she was like, you'll never get that. Like, 150 pro points in a season, Spencer? Like, you'd have to go to like 150 events. It's like, lifetime, honey.
If it had to come in a season, that would be, no one would be able to vote.
Yeah, just, you'd have, I was like, you'd have to win all 4 pro tours. And she's like, well, why don't you do that? And I was like, nobody does that.
I mean, Kai might have been able to come close to 150 in a season at one point.
Probably.
That's probably the only person to ever be in that ballpark.
You know who could get 150 pro points in a season if they wanted to is our sponsor, Oasis Games. You can check them out at mtgoasis.com. You can get 15% off your first order by using code CCMTG at checkout. You can get 4% off of every order by using code WITHTHEBEGIN. We love Oasis Games. They, you know, they supply us with our cards, and we really appreciate them, so we hope that you will check them out. Fast shipping, amazing service. Check them out, OasisGamesLC.com. If you're looking for playmats and sleeves, deck boxes, stuff like that, check out InGaming. Use the code CCMTG10 at checkout. It gives us a little bit of a kickback to upgrade equipment, things like that. So thank you so much to that sponsor as well. You can check out the rest of the network at constructivecriticism.com or on the YouTube channel. We have the Trophy Mages. We have Common Knowledge. We have Homeward Path. Tons of stuff coming out every week, as well as the Contracted Clash series. So check it out, constructivecriticism.com. It means the world to us when you go check out the website, subscribe, hit that bell on YouTube, stuff like that. So, but the point of this podcast is always improving. We believe that you're not getting better, you're getting worse. We want to be doing what we can all the time to be improving ourselves. And in doing so, we hope that we help the listeners just a little bit. So this week, let's talk about what we've done to get better at Magic the Gathering. And Michael, why don't you go ahead and start?
Well, I feel like I did a lot of thinking about Team Unified Modern is a strange format. It's interesting in that you're sort of trying to predict what other people will bring and then line up decks against their imaginary decks. And one of the hardest things about doing that is that you have to sort of find a middle ground between trying to metagame and just playing kind of nonsense. And I came up with a whole bunch of different lineups, but by starting to sort of narrow the constraints on at least a couple of the decks, I feel like we have been able to make some progress on choosing all of the decks. So it's kind of a fun exercise. Deck building is one of my favorite parts of Magic, and getting to spend some time really thinking about exactly not only what archetypes you're interested in, but how would you build these, right? Like what sideboard cards or lands or fetch lands or, you know, flex slots, where could these decks overlap and how would you build them to avoid that kind of stuff? I really have enjoyed it.
Can I actually ask? I actually don't know what our third deck is.
Well, I don't think we do either. But
oh, we know two of them. Okay.
Yes. Talked to Matt about it a fair bit, and we have a couple of options that I'm not 100% sure about, but I think we'll end up with a good third deck.
Okay. So, this week has been... I've played more Magic over the last, like, week and a half than I've probably played in, like, last couple months. I mean, it's been really refreshing. So today, I was sick, stayed home sick, and did my Trophy Mages stream a little bit early. But one of the things that I did is I played Mono Red on stream, and I vocalized. This is something that I actually really like about streaming, and this is just something I plan on doing. Actually, I want to talk about my match with Danny too. I want to talk about all this. So this is something that I did at day two of GPC Sacramento that I did against Danny Cathro at the RBT this weekend, and something that I get to do on stream. And that's just literally like talk about blocks, talk about lineups, talk about things like that. So it's actually really helped me get better at Magic, and I'm going to continue doing that. And I think I've gotten better at Magic this week more than anything else. I started out 0-3 on stream and then went 1-4 on stream. But I think it's the most I've improved playing Magic the Gathering on stream in a long time, even though I was sick and grumpy. And I took a little bit of a nap, played some Infect, went 3-2, and then 1-4. And still, I think I learned more in all of those matches of Magic than I have in a long time. And I think I'm getting to the point where I'm learning in Magic a lot again, understanding like what I'm doing wrong, things like that, in ways that I haven't in a long time. And something that I often preach is like, don't take your record into how much better you're getting. Take your learning experiences into how much better you're getting, and then see if the results follow later. And that's kind of where my head's at right now, Michael.
Yeah, I think that trying to focus on sort of understanding the mistakes, when you're at a level where it's not realistic to expect perfect play with a given deck, I think that trying to identify where things are going wrong is just as important as trying to play perfectly. And I think trying to take away sort of like, okay, I made this mistake, but here's what I expected to happen, and here's what happened. You know, why did these differ? I think just trying to get more comfortable with it's sort of like last week, right? It's like getting comfortable with self-criticism and introspection, where there are a lot of times where you're playing things that you're just not going to play perfectly, right? If you haven't played a lot of Infect, you're probably not just going to pick it up and have everything be intuitive. And Mono Red is sort of the same way. People, you know, often like to talk about decks as being easy or hard to play, but it's very difficult to grab actually anything and play it perfectly with zero reps. So I think just being open to, just like even as an attitude thing, just being open to learning, open to being wrong, open to understanding why things are happening to you is really important and can be really gratifying.
So I'd like to explain a situation that happened at the RBDQ this week that Danny and I both weren't sure what the correct play was. Oh man, it's been too many days. I don't know that I'm going to get this right where I would have gotten it right on Monday. But I'm going to try. So, I'm just going to say, like, kind of the last bit of it. So, I have a, what's the 5/5 angel called?
Lyra.
I have a Lyra in play. And Danny plays, a Soulscar Mage off the top. And Danny has zero cards in hand, but he has a, I must have had something else. I might have had a knight in play too or something. I think I did have a knight in play. So I had a knight in play and a Lyra in play, and Danny has zero cards in hand. I'm either at, so here's the thing, I don't remember my life total at this point, but I'm either at two or I'm definitely not at two. I must have been at four. Or seven. I'm at seven. Yes. This is the worst podcast. I would have gotten this right on Monday. So I have a Teferi in hand, and Danny has Soulscar Mage that he just played off the top, and Goblin Chain Whirler. So I play Teferi, and I minus the Chain Whirler, two cards down, with Danny having zero cards, attack with Lyra, say go. So I now, if Danny top decks a, the reason I did this is because I'm like, okay, Danny, if Danny top decks a land, I actually just win this game now. Like, this game is actually over. In hindsight, my thought is I actually should bottom the Soulscar Mage. Or I should ditch the Soulscar Mage, block with the Knight, or let the Teferi die to the
attack from the Chain Whirler.
Yeah, to the attack from the Chain Whirler. So what ended up happening is Danny draws a card. It's a Goblin Chain Whirler. He plays it. Gives... No. It's not a Chain Whirler. It must have been Chain Whirler. I don't... Oh, it was a Chain Whirler. He minus one's on my Lyra. I attack with that Lyra. I play another Lyra to give Pseudo-Vigilance and have a 5-5 again and pass the turn. Danny untaps, draws Chandra, minuses Chandra on my Lyra. If I had just minused on the Soulscar Mage, I actually think I win that game. But I don't know if it's correct to minus on the Soulscar Mage, and I wanted your thoughts.
So...
I'm really sorry if this is really bad podcasting to the listeners.
No. Okay,
but...
so let's run... I can run through this again from my side, make sure I'm understanding. So we have a Teferi that we just played, so it's at 4. We have a Knight token in play. We have a Lyra. We're at 7, so we're not really in burn range.
I think we have a Knight in play, but yeah, I think we're at 7. I think we're at 7 after the attack, specifically.
Okay, so we go to 7.
Right.
So we have a blocker, and if we minus on... Danny has no cards in hand at this point?
Danny has no cards.
Okay, so I think the secret is that the Goblin Chain Whirler just doesn't do anything.
That is what the conclusion I came to later, is I should have just... The actual only... Because he's playing Flame of Keld... The actually only way to win is to shrink my Lyras, and I need to minus on the other card and let my Teferi die.
I mean, you can just block the Chain Whirler hypothetically.
Yeah,
right?
I think what ended up happening, he might have had a card, and I think the Knight died and the Teferi died anyway. Whatever the situation was, is I ended up with just a 4/4 Lyra, and then Knight the next turn off of my draw step.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that fundamentally you probably just have to understand in that spot that if he doesn't have Hazred in his deck, which wouldn't make sense in a sideboarded game against blue-white given your access to, like, Seal Away and Cast Out, right? I don't think you can lose with him on one card a turn, especially when the third card is going to be a Soulscar Mage, which does nothing as he plays it.
Right. And the Chandra also does nothing because I get a gain life while killing it through the air.
Right, exactly. But I just don't know what outs he even has at that point. It has to be like Fight with Fire or Bane.
Yeah, which he says he wasn't playing at all. And that I should... He actually said, I think you should know and should have known that these decks weren't playing this anymore.
Yeah, I think just if the Soulscar Mage is gone, it seems hard to imagine. The secret is that he's going to have to kill two Lyras, right? Like, you have a backup Lyra.
Yeah, so the Lyra in play was a 4/4 from the last Soulscar Mage.
Sure. Okay.
Or from the last Chain Whirler. So I have a 4/4 Lyra in play that would have ended up dying to the Chandra. But I think that I should have attacked, flipped the... The truth is, I think I should put zero emphasis on protecting Teferi and save the extra Lyra for like when it's the most important.
Right. Right. I think that's possible. I think, ultimately, if you tuck the Soulscar Mage, it's just hard to imagine a sequence that gets you.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm glad you easily came to the same conclusion I came to as I thought about this quite a bit.
Well, I mean, it happens, though. Like, sometimes you make a play where your mind is kind of one place, and later you're thinking, what am I actually playing around by making this play? And I think both in the moment and after, you know, it's valuable to try to be cognizant of sort of what decisions you have and like what ultimately matters given which decision you make.
But right? I think it's also a weakness of like playing it's a weakness of playing like 2000 games with one deck, right? It's like your number one priority in most games is to protect Teferi because you just pull away and win, when the truth is that the thing that actually mattered was not the Teferi and was actually the Lyra in this case.
Sure, it's true, and I think ultimately all you can really do is learn from it and move on.
Well, there's always improvement for this week. I hope that was helpful for the listeners. It was certainly helpful for me to look back on it. So we're going to do... There's no Deck Doctor this week and no Power Rankings. We had a bunch of Patreon questions this week from a thread. And I'm going to post another thread, and we're going to add them all up and do a Patreon question episode next week. So no Patreon question this week. We're going to just... double up and just read all of them at once, and then I'll post a Patreon question thread every single week, specifically in the Facebook group, but I'll do the same thing in the Patreon for the other patrons as well. So, all right. So, let's get into our deck of the week. So, this is a segment we're bringing back. It's something that Michael and I wanted to do a long time ago. But kind of got derailed when I got my new job, and, you know, things changed at work. But I want to, instead of just every week doing a power rankings, if we have an opportunity to just talk about a deck, I want to do that. So this week we're going to talk about Bant Spirits. The list that I have pulled up, Michael, is Andre's, but we don't just have to talk about Andre's list. But
I like his list.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about Andre's list, but I want to, really quick, if you give us a simple summary of, like, what Bant Spirits is trying to do in Modern right now.
Okay, so fundamentally, the reason to be interested in Bant Spirits is the printing of Supreme Phantom. So you get another lord, and one of the cool things with this lord is that it makes your Mausoleum Wanderers a lot better. It makes your Spell Quellers a lot better. Your Spell Quellers don't die to Lightning Bolt with a Drogskull. Well, Drogskull Captain makes them hexproof. Supreme Phantom makes them live through it. But I think that sort of having the extra lord density, you have so many disruptive creatures that are kind of free to play, that when you also have the density of lords, you're sort of doing like if you imagine playing Merfolk, this is like Merfolk if all Merfolk had flying, and all of the, and instead of playing, you know, just like 16 lords, you were playing like 8 lords and a bunch of creatures with really sweet ETBs and like kind of in-play static abilities.
Yeah, I've played a little bit of Spirits, and Mausoleum Wanderer is like significantly better than Kurt's Catcher.
Yeah. I mean, the flying part, like, Matt and I have played a little bit of various Spirit decks, and it, like, it does a pretty good, like, flying Wild Mikotal impression a lot of the time.
It really does.
It's very powerful.
Yeah, so, with that being said, you're kind of like a fish deck that's, you know, not bad.
Yeah, it's like the spiritual successor of Merfolk.
Yeah. You know, what do you think are, like, the key cards in this deck outside of the lords? We talked a little bit about Mausoleum Wanderer, but, you know, there are blue-white spirit decks that aren't banned. So are Noble Hierarch and Collected Company something that you really think that you want right now?
So Collected Company is really powerful in the grindy matchups. I would imagine it's also pretty outstanding versus humans. One of the other things that Noble Hierarch does is it gives you a high density of one-drops, whether you choose to play Aether Vial like Andre did or whether you choose not to. And I think that, much like we've seen in the humans deck, one of the things that's most important and powerful in these archetypes is really getting on the board out in front of your opponent. And Noble Hierarch in combination with Mausoleum Wanderer really increases your density of explosive draws.
Yeah, one thing that I have a question about as far as like this deck versus humans is we don't see things like Thalia in the main deck of this deck. Does that affect the matchups in a pretty significant way?
So what I would say is that Mausoleum Wanderer is often going to just be better than Thalia in this deck.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're playing Collected Company specifically, it's a little bit rough. Like, Collected Company and only 21 lands, it's a little bit rough to be playing Thalias unless you're 100% sure they're going to be very impactful. My guess is that Andre is not usually signing out Collected Companies even when he's bringing in Thalias.
Sure.
But that he's only having Thalias in matchups where it's going to hurt his opponent more than him.
So, I mean, I guess you're kind of speaking to what I was thinking, which is that, you know, kind of like Curse Catcher does, Mausoleum Wanderer taxes your opponent in similar ways to Thalia, where if a spell is really important to them, they have to either sequence incorrectly or weirdly, or they have to just not cast that spell until they can afford to.
Yeah, one of the things that this deck has, like, so Andre has cut a lot of the weaker spirits from the list. He's only playing a single Rattle Chains and 3 Selfless Spirits, focusing more on lords and more on spells that are sort of individually powerful. But one of the things that these decks have going for them, especially when you start playing Aether Vial and Collected Company, is that you can get into spots where it's very difficult for your opponent to figure out what you're representing. And I think when you're playing a deck with Path to Exile, Collected Company, Spell Queller, plus Aether Vial, and knowing you have that one Rattle Chains in the main, it's just hard to figure out what you're trying to play around and why. And I would imagine that there are a lot of blowouts, like, against targeted removal, but there can also be blowouts against, you know, Terminus with countering that.
Sure.
And there can even be blowouts against something like Supreme Verdict every once in a while because you can hit a Selfless Spirit or a Spell Dweller.
Yeah, I think that when this deck rises up, it makes decks like I think it makes specifically like control and Scapeshift significantly worse.
Yes, I would not want to play Scapeshift against this. I don't really want to play blue-white control against this. I would not want to play like Storm against this, Ad Nauseam against this. I don't want to play any spell-based combo deck, and I don't want to play a really passive control deck.
Yeah, one of the things that I have questions about, because I played a lot of Merfolk and Legacy and stuff like that. How are matchups like kind of the combo matchups, right? And I want to even, this sounds weird, but I kind of want to include Tron in the combo matchups. So one of the things that Tron does similar to combo decks is it like, if you let it go a long time, it just wins, right? Similar to something like Ironworks combo or something like Storm. Like, if you let them go too long, like, they're just going to sculpt their hands and win. Whereas Tron, I mean, it's basically the same way. It just does it with its lands instead of its cards in hand.
Right.
Where does this deck sit against that type of stuff?
My guess is that your game one against Tron is not great, but you do have Selfless Spirit, which, you know, gives you some outs against, like, O-Stone, stuff like that. Karn isn't really very good against you.
That was my thought, is that Karn was bad
against you. Company should give you some explosive draws. So my guess is that game one is not great, but you can win, especially on the play. In the post-board games, on the play, at least, you're going to have Thalia, which is quite good on the play. You're also going to have both Damning Spheres, three Stony Silences, and the two Unified Wills, as well as likely the third Geist. So my guess is that in the post-board games, you're actually in pretty... and you can cut some of the more, like, tempo-related elements and becomes more of like a... like, kind of a brute force deck,
sure.
Right? Where you're just, like, trying to slam, like... Damping Sphere, or like Guy into Damping Sphere into Lord.
It's funny because like all three of the decks that I mentioned, kind of outside of Stony Silence for Storm, all of those cards are good against all of those decks. So I think that, you know, this deck is really showing the power of its own sideboard in that.
Yeah, being able to play white decks that don't really, like, you can obviously side out the Vials if that matters. But I've also played Vial in Stony Silence decks, or Stony Silence in Vial decks before, and it's not that big a deal. But being able to play all of these powerful white hate cards that don't really interact very much with your own deck, I mean, if you want to call Damping Sphere, Rest in Peace, Stony Silence, and really Thalia, sometimes even Worship feels the same way.
Yep.
And I think being able to go so deep on kind of density of those effects is really powerful, and also because they all do slightly different things, gives you a lot of play in different matchups.
So, I think we've covered kind of like a large portion of the field. I think that it's pretty safe to say that, you know, things like Jund and Mardu are going to be like coin flip matchups for you. But what about like Hollow Wund and Vengevine? Are those things that you worry about? Do you think you're favored? Like, how does this work with this deck?
My guess is that Jund and Mardu are relatively unfavored.
Against you?
No, unfavorable matchups.
Oh, so my initial impression was that, but I leaned so hard on those mid-range decks that I was trying to compensate for my own biases.
I mean, I'm sure you can get them sometimes, and, like, Collected Company is obviously really potent.
I mean, Flyers are good against both those decks, right? So, like, the fact that you are this deck instead of other decks that you could be is probably good, but I mean, if I were being, like, 1,000% honest, I would think that Mardu and Jund are actually your worst matchups. Maybe along with, like, Grixis, Death Shadow, due to... I think that those three decks, specifically.
Death Shadow's probably a little bit less bad. Geist is really, really good against them.
Well, that's true against all those decks, though. I mean, that's probably not true against Mardu. Mardu probably just doesn't care.
Or Jund. I mean, the biggest problem with Jund is Tarmogoyf.
Sure, but, like, you... That's, like, the only card you care... I don't know. You have a lot of flyers. And, like, if Gyphus of St. Draft is dealing 4 damage against Jund, it's probably doing its job.
Maybe. My experience with this kind of deck has always been that you're sort of soft to getting critical pieces from your hand picked apart.
That's true. I think the Inquisition is probably insane against this deck.
Yeah, so I would say that, like, the base black mid-range decks are probably not great. My guess would be that those are typically going to be unfavored, but I also don't know that those are in an especially good position right now. So, you know, although I don't know that this deck has good matchups against everything, which would obviously be, you know, kind of an unreasonable statement. I think it's a really powerful deck in the right metagame.
Sure.
Cool. So, what do we think of that Hollow One Ventrine stuff?
My guess is that your Hollow One matchup is a little bit shaky. I would imagine it's okay on the play. Mausoleum Wanderer is probably powerful. I mean, you have Path and Company, and you have a bunch of flyers, but they do sort of have a bunch of Tarmogoyfs, you know, however you want to define that. So my guess would be that that matchup is okay, unfavored, and my guess is Ventrine would be probably unfavored as well, despite multiple sideboard Rest in Pieces. I think realistically you're just going to have trouble.
I think Rest in Pieces is just too slow. Like,
yeah, I've had that experience a lot. Like, you're generally going to lose game one because you're just unlikely to draw the right mix of interaction in the dark.
Sure.
And then you'll get one game on the play with Rest in Peace, and if you have it on turn two and have a hand that is good in addition to that, that's probably going to be good enough. But then you're going to have a game on the draw, and a lot of the Ventrine draws are so explosive that it's really tough.
So, any tips and tricks for somebody that's trying to pick up a deck like this tomorrow, Michael?
I would mostly say the hardest card to play with for me is usually Mausoleum Wanderer. Just trying to understand, like, when concealing information is worth more than a point of damage. Like, when you should cast things main phase that don't have to be...
You actually defined why these, what's the 1/1 that sacrifices for red to draw cards in Mono Red today?
Bowmite Courier?
You just defined why Bowmite Courier decks are so hard for me. I just don't actually understand when a damage is worth more than a card or worth more than X information or whatever.
Yeah, I think some of it is trying to count ahead a little bit. Like, it's a little bit harder on turn two sometimes, but my inclination is generally to try to play... It depends on how good I think my opponent is, to some extent, right? I think if I'm likely to be able to get them with something a little bit trickier, that has some value. But at the same time, you know, pushing the most damage you can while still playing around what you can is really what you're trying to do. And if you can get Lords in play, Mausoleum Wanderer is very, very tough to deal with.
Well, this deck got Andrei Strosky to not quit Magic all of a sudden. And I think that one of the things that I really like is how tuned his list is. 2 Phantasmal Image, 1 Rattle Change, 3 Selfless Spirit, 3 Aether Vial tells me that, like, he knew what he wanted and why. And I would... I hope he writes an article about this deck, because I would be interested to see, like, why he wanted stuff, you know, how it worked and stuff like that. But we might go back to Andre's deck list if we need to talk about sideboards for a little bit, which is our training rounds, which we're getting into right now. So I want to talk about understanding sideboards. And the reason we're doing this is I want to do episodes focusing on each of the host's strengths of this podcast. And this was Michael's strength mentioned by me. So I have a list of questions, 3 questions by me, 3 questions by Matt, to specifically talk to you about sideboarding. And I'm just basically going to do an interview, if that's okay, Michael.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you want to clarify something, go for it. If something I'm saying you think is right or wrong, I'm, yeah, like, totally open to feedback. And
yeah. So I'll just kind of switch off between mine and Matt's questions. And the first question that I have is this a skill you find you practice? So, for example, when you're looking at a sideboard, do you constantly try and guess the ins and outs? And then do you test those theories if that's the case?
One of the things that I spend quite a bit of time doing is when I see decks that have done well, especially like in larger events, I generally assume that the person has a good plan and the sideboard is cohesive. So one of the things that I'll sit down and try to do is look at their sideboard and main deck and think about how I would want a sideboard in different matchups, even how I have been sideboarding in different matchups, and then sort of try to go from their sideboard and compare that to, you know, if I sideboard like this, what cards am I not touching enough in their sideboard to, like, justify the slots? How do I think they're sideboarding? And sometimes what you'll find is that how you think someone else is sideboarding based on the list they submitted is probably a little bit different than you, and I think that's where you can really get kind of interesting information.
I'd like to say that I really am glad you said this, because I'm sure that you also have this experience as a podcast host, but the number one thing that I get requests for is sideboard guides. Like, it's not even particularly close. And for me, it's like, listen, I can write out the sidebar guide for you, but it's not actually as helpful as you doing the work, getting out a pen and paper, and then sending me what you think the sideboard guide should be, and then me responding to that. Because that's a conversation instead of, you know, a part of, like, this, just a cheat sheet. And I, like, the conversation is so much more important. And when I, it was funny, like, I spent quite a bit of time basically all day today on stream was just me talking about sideboarding, trying different things, and trying to understand, like, the sideboard I was playing, because I was basically playing Quentin's deck with two different cards from the PTQ the week before. My deck was terrible, but I just wanted to understand the reasons for things.
Yeah, I think that ultimately, when you're looking at other people's sideboards, what I'm really trying to do is think about why they might want to do things. And it's not necessarily like, oh, I don't like to sideboard like that, or I think this is... It's not necessarily about something being better or worse, but I think identifying where you're thinking differently than people who are doing really well is probably, like, one of the easiest opportunities to grow and learn.
Cool. The next question is from Matt. He says, Matt's first question is, are you looking at what a deck looks like as a 60 in a post-ported configuration, or are you just seeing which cards are good or bad and not really worrying too much about cohesion?
So, that's a really good question, and I think it depends on the kind of deck. I think the more rare a deck is, often the more that you have to worry about sort of keeping cohesion, whereas, like, mid-rangey style decks, like, the interactions between cards are often just that we're playing a powerful card and then a powerful card and a powerful... We were trying to line up good things in a matchup more than we're trying to, like, play to specific board states or combinations of cards. So I would say the only thing that I generally am focused on in terms of that, just like in terms of building post-board decks, is making sure that I'm cognizant of what's happening to the curve. That, like, and just sort of understanding which cards have big deck building requirements, right? So, like, you can say in some matchups, like, Hazoret, Chandra, and Glorybringer are all great, but I probably can't side into the 3 Hazoret, 4 Chandra, 4 Glorybringer configuration, right?
This was, like, the conversation that I was having on stream all day. It was like, listen, right. Like, I'm playing against red-black. I know that Hazoret's my best card in this matchup. The problem is that I think that Glorybringer post-board is actually the best card. And what I want to do is I want to not have Hazoret, and I actually want to have Chandra instead. And here's the reasons why. And one of the reasons why is because I think that I just want to, like, after talking to one of the people on stream, was like, I kind of just want to be a removal deck, and if I want to do that, I kind of just want to play Banefire a post-board against in the mirror. And I don't know what was correct, but I just wanted to have a reason for it and understand, like, listen, I can't play 2 Glorybringer, 3 Chandra, 4 Hazorets, and actually win games of Magic. Like, it's not going to happen.
Right. So I think that it's kind of finding the balance, right? The more linear a deck is, the more important that is. But when you're looking at decks that have specific requirements, or that, like, you're trying to take a certain role in a matchup, you have to be more cognizant of how the, like, more big picture deck you're siding into interacts in the matchup, rather than just specific cards that are good.
My second question is, if you could give a piece of advice to somebody who's looking at a sideboard and helping the sideboard, does looking at a sideboard help you understand what the good and bad matchups are, and how does it do that?
So I think it does to some extent. My experience with this, and tell me if you feel differently, is that what's going to happen, you're going to have to think about reasons why matchups can be bad. And I would say the biggest reason that matchups are bad is because you have a bunch of cards that are bad in game one. So sometimes just sheer volume of cards will show you that a matchup is bad. But sometimes specific cards in a sideboard will show you that, like, maybe we're having to play really narrow cards for certain matchups, right? Like maybe we are playing Hour of Glory out of red black because this person has decided Hazoret is specifically the card that's giving them problems. And I think that, like, beyond just volume, the next thing you're probably looking for are cards with really, like, niche applications and sort of understanding, like, how bad does a matchup have to be before I'm willing to play a 13-card sideboard in every other matchup because I wouldn't touch this card there.
Yeah.
But I need this for a specific one.
I think that this is really relevant because, to me, it's like, this actually might be a weakness of mine, I'm not sure, but I care so much about the player of the draw when I'm sideboarding, and that applies to when I'm building sideboards. Like, if I think that a card is just unplayable on the draw versus a deck, I need to find enough slots to take that card out on the draw. And that means that volume is going to change dramatically, and depending on the format, that affects, like, the type of cards that I can play. Because if I have one card that's a 4 of in my deck that's just horrible on the draw, that means that I need a deck card that's a 4 of, or 4 cards that can replace that card that are good in multiple matchups, because I can't actually give up that much equity.
Right. So then sometimes looking at someone else's sideboard, you sort of have to decide whether or not there are cards that just get worse in post-board games in general, or whether or not there are cards that are specifically bad in matchups when you're looking at, like, when you're trying to figure out how they're sideboarding.
I think you answered that question really well. Can we kind of wrap it up, though? Because I think that we went in two directions. And I think the answer is yes. I think that when you're looking at somebody's sideboard, you're saying that, yes, there are two things to consider. Volume and narrowness. So if a card is super narrow that it could only be for one matchup, that matchup is probably bad. And also, if there's an extreme volume of cards, that matchup is also probably bad.
Yes, and I think it speaks, there are two different reasons why matchups are bad most of the time, right? Either it's, like, volume of cards that are bad in general, or I can't beat one of the cards you often play.
Cool.
And they're kind of different reasons for a matchup being bad, but they both sort of indicate the same thing.
Matt's second question is, if they conflict, how do you weigh curve against power level when sideboarding?
I think this depends so much on the deck we're playing, right? If we're playing mono red, we need to be really careful about trying to side into a more powerful deck because, you know, say our Bowmak Careers get, like, every card in the deck gets worse when we start mangling the curve. Sometimes you're going to need to play cards, like, that are bad against Goblin Chain Whirler in your Flame of Keld deck, even in a post-board game against a deck with Chain Whirlers.
Can we actually just, like, look at Andre's sideboard for a second? So, for example, sure. We're playing against Tron. We have 2 Dampening Spheres, 3 Stony Silence, Thalia's Unified Wills that could all come in that matchup. Maybe even the Geyser Saint Draft. Like, what do you do? You can't just board in all of those non-creatures.
I mean, my thought is that if you were realistically, you're looking at, like, if you have so many cards for a matchup that it's actually too many, and I don't know that that's the case here, but maybe you have to decide if some are better situationally. Like, maybe you decide that Stony Silence and Thalia are better on the play, but on the draw, so, like, you're going to board in, like, 7 on the play, like Damping Sphere, Stony, and Thalia, but on the draw, you're going to board in the Unified Wills and the Damping Spheres and the Stonies.
Or that, like, makes a lot of sense to me.
Right, and I think, like, it's not just about looking at a sideboard and saying, oh, this card can sometimes be good against this deck, but I think if we can go a little bit deeper and say, so Thalia's good on the play because if they kept a hand with Sylvan Scrying or with a turn 3 7 drop, it's going to disrupt that. But Thalia's maybe less good on the draw because they can always still resolve a Sylvan Scrying before I can play a Thalia. Or better on the play than the draw because it can shut down an expedition map. So maybe you're going to say I'm boarding Damping Sphere no matter what because it's going to make their hands less explosive. But in regards to other pieces, I want more or less player draw, depending on, like, if I've seen different cards from them. I mean, obviously that's not happening with Tron, but with, like, archetypes with more variation.
Sure. I use Tron because of the number of cards in this sideboard that you could board in versus Tron. But we could do the same thing versus Storm, right? We have 2 Damping Sphere, 3 Rest in Peace, 2 Thalia, 2 Unified Will. Geist is probably not horrible in that matchup either. Like, there's so many cards against Storm here, and even if you look at something like Affinity, you know, you well, Affinity's actually a bad version, but...
So, right, but I think that some of this comes down to, if you're not sure, play some games in a sideboard configuration. Maybe you're fine playing, you know, maybe you can side out a bunch of creatures and your Aether Vials and your Collected Companies still end up good enough and everything is fine, but the only way to learn in a lot of these spots is just to play a little bit and kind of see what works for you. It's nice if you get a sideboard guide, but I think that understanding Andre would do a certain thing in a certain matchup or differ on the play and draw, like actually understanding why he's making those choices and learning that through gameplay will help you build better sideboards and will help you better kind of evaluate your roles, play and draw in pre and post board games.
Let's go to my next question, which is, what is the best way to apply another person's sideboarding thoughts without getting stuck with their mistakes? So, this, let me clarify this. So, it's super easy to copy artifact hate from another sideboard without thinking of better solutions for the problem. So, if we identify the actual problem, are we trying to solve? Do we make sure that we ourselves are solving the problem the best way that we can? So, for example, somebody might hop into GP with a bunch of Stony Silences, right? But you might realize that, you know, your deck actually would be better taken advantage of because of the metagame in, like, let's say you're playing Naya for some reason with Ancient Grudges, right? Like, you know, maybe you don't expect a lot of things that Stony Silence is going to be against in a weird metagame that's not the current modern one, but you kind of get what I'm saying?
Right, that, like, what meta cards for and how are we broadly, like, let's say, you know, you're playing a bunch of Stony Silences and you're boarding them in against Affinity, but ultimately you might decide that although Stony Silence is good against Affinity, it's too narrow or the other decks it hits. I used to think about this, the old Death Shadow sideboards, like when we were playing Gataxian Probe, what used to be the thought process in the sideboards was that you would play three cards for every matchup for like a bunch of different matchups, but two of them would overlap for other matchups. So you'd be trying to build this, like, sort of interwoven sideboard where, like, all these matchups would have three cards you'd board in, like, but only one of them was specifically for that matchup, and one of them went with, you know, A and B, and one of them went with B and C.
Right.
And I think that sort of understanding what you're trying to beat, but also where you can find additional value in freeing up sideboard slots, like, because maybe you thought, you know, okay, well, I need Stony Silence for Affinity, but my KCI matchup is good and my Death Shadow matchup is bad, so maybe I should try something like Fiery. That would still be good against Affinity, but not be good against, like, but could also be good against Death Shadow. Or, like, it, just finding cards with multiple applications and understanding that we don't need to just play cards that say destroy target artifact for Affinity.
Exactly.
Or cards that say exile all cards in a graveyard.
Yeah.
For,
so,
you know, whatever.
So I feel like we still haven't answered the question yet, though. Like, how do we do this?
So what I would say is, when you're looking at someone else's list, understand that it's only a starting point, that just because someone else did well with something, it's a good opportunity to learn. But the reason that I think sideboard guides end up being overused is because instead of taking this as an opportunity to learn, we're just taking it as the opportunity to do no work. And yeah. I think that if we figure out sort of, okay, so which of these matchups are bad and why are they bad and how do we fix them, you can sometimes come to more, I would say, like, more net efficient combinations of sideboard cards, right, that give you an extra slot for a matchup here or there.
It's really, it sucks because, like, I want to give people sideboard guides. I'm like, yeah, I'm like, I would happily do this for you, but I don't know what's it's funny because, like, I asked Matt for a sideboard guide the other day. I was like, listen, I'm gonna go jam your deck for two leagues this weekend before the RPTQ. You know, can you give me a sideboard guide just so that I can, like, get a starting point and then we can talk about it after? I didn't end up playing Matt's deck, but it was really funny because he laughed because he knows how much I hate sideboard guides. And I think that things like that depend. I also want to apologize to people. There's probably been, like, 30 messages that you've heard going on right now. If you're listening to the audio podcast, my son is sick and the babysitter is messaging my wife and they have me in the messenger thread, and I have to leave it open because the show notes are on Facebook, so I'm really sorry.
So I guess what I would say with regards to like sideboard guides is that they have value in that they're providing you with someone whose opinion you trust and respect. You're getting their thoughts, but ultimately I think a lot of improving is learning to sort of trust and respect your own opinion. And I think that growing as a player is often going to involve not necessarily deviating from what other people think, but like understanding why they're thinking that way. And you can come to the same conclusion or a different conclusion, but you kind of have to get there yourself.
Yeah, so a really good example of this was today in sideboarding. I found that I was sideboarding very, very few cards when I was playing Infect. It was like, this card's not great, this card's not great. And I found myself wishing that I could look at sideboard guides not to copy the sideboard guide, but actually to see how people were sideboarding to understand why cards were in sideboards. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, I think that that's true, and that's especially true when you have kind of going into Matt's third question where he says, do you find it easier or harder to understand a combo sideboard or
right.
a mid-range sideboard,
right.
like speaking to linear versus less linear decks? It can kind of go both ways, right? Like, what I would say is that in general, combo decks, you're often siding out like the same cards all the time. Like, there are three or four cards that you're just like, well, these are the worst cards. So
right.
when we're making changes to the deck, usually these guys...
You know, it's super easy to sideboard out Dryad Arbor. It's like, okay, well,
right.
this is not the...
Sometimes it just sucks.
Right. It's super easy. It's like, okay, this is not a Dryad Arbor matchup. But, like, it's like, okay, I probably don't need Rancor in this matchup because it's bad. But
sometimes trying to understand like Rancor versus Groundswell versus
right.
Might of Old
exactly.
Earth, and understanding that there are like probably actually correct configurations for, oh, Might of Old Krosa is ever so slightly better in this matchup and ever so slightly worse in this matchup.
Right.
I think that kind of stuff can be challenging. And then just sort of understanding that linear decks, there's kind of a cutoff point typically, like you can't really sideboard in the full 15. We're looking at sort of a, you know,
it's incremental improvements, right?
Easy, and after that they hurt.
Yeah, it's there are decks where you're making incremental improvements. There are decks where you're trying to drastically improve your deck on the play or the draw and things like that. And I think that this is one of the things that I think that we think that we're good at, but I think that most people are just really bad at because they're lazy.
It's kind of hard. My thought is that like linear decks are kind of pigeonholed into their role, and as like a bigger picture way of thinking about why we're sideboarding like we sideboard, I think that this is important to understand. Linear decks are basically always going to play the same role in a matchup pre and post board,
right?
Because the deck only really does one thing. The less linear your deck is, the more you can change roles in different matchups, right? If we're playing Abzan mid, we can get Veener against control and, you know, try to take like an aggro role, and we can sort of try to get under the we can sort of try to play a control role against the aggro decks, right? And I think that that's the kind of thing that you're not really going to be able to do with something like Infect. You're sort of trying to optimize your deck for a given matchup, but ultimately you're going to try to kill them on turn 3 with Blighted Agent.
So why don't you answer Matt's question really quick that you had just mentioned?
So my guess is that if I'm completely unfamiliar with a deck, it's probably harder to figure out a sideboard with linear decks, just because if you've never actually played a deck before, those three or four cards you're allowed to touch are... I mean, I remember looking at like KCI for the first few times and really not having any idea like what you could cut without really impacting your ability to combo, for example. But once you, you know, read Matt Ness's article or whatever, and it's like always, you know, like one Sphere, one Terrarian, you know, one Mind Stone, one whatever, right? You can pretty much just be like, you can pretty much get the rationale for what he cuts depending on what he sides in. And I think it usually had to do with color requirements, but it was like fairly simplistic, and once you'd kind of seen it once, you mostly knew what you were doing, depending on how many cards you wanted to sideboard. What I would say is that overall, nonlinear decks require a little more finesse because it's often about responding to nuances of your opponent's list and trying to get into very specific configurations depending on how your opponent plays or what you're trying to do in a sideboard. It's just, there's more flexibility for better or worse.
Yeah. Well, I think that we've covered this really well. I think that I don't think that a wrap-up is needed on this one. I think that each of these questions was very independent of their, and had their own reasons for why they were asked. And so, thank you so much for answering those, Michael. And I hope the listeners learned a lot. So, don't forget to check us out on patreon.com/ccmtg. Our next Patreon goal is probably going to change. There are 100% major changes coming to the Patreon. A lot of reasons for this is because I think I have a better understanding today than I did over a year ago when I changed the Patreon goals last time, and when I did the Patreon. And Matt and Michael have kind of committed to being more vocal in the Constructive Critics group. So if you want to be a patron of $5 or more per month, go to the Constructive Critics group. I think Michael even today, just or yesterday was it? You're having a conversation
about
About Dex versus Troit and things like that. And both Matt and Michael are going to be more vocal about that. Tonight we're going to post this deck list. So if you want to see the deck list that at least three of the four of us, including Quentin, are playing at the PTQ this weekend, definitely check that out. And that is kind of the direction the Patreon will head. We want to make sure that this content is helpful. Like, you shouldn't have to be a patron to get the benefits from the show, but we want to give you this segment was exactly what I wanted, right? Like, this training grounds, I hope, made you better at Magic, and that wins you enough matches of Magic that you can kick out something back, and then also you can get a couple of different types of benefits from being a patron from there. So check it out, patreon.com/ccmtg. You can find me at Spencer13H on Twitter. You can find Michael at MagicBikeMTG. You can find Matt at The Witch Cling. And you can find the podcast at CCMTG. We post this podcast to YouTube. We post it to MTGcast, post it to constructivecriticism.com. Check us out in all those places. If you're on YouTube, hit that sub button, hit the bell. Make sure to leave a review on iTunes if you can. You can join the conversation on the Constructive Critics group if you're a patron of $5 or more, or just on the Constructive Criticism family. There's a different post by one of the shows every single day to try and get the conversation started, and then listeners have questions. They interact with each other, they post deck lists, things like that. You can join the climb by messaging me at Spencer13H or Dev, or you can message Quentin at Urshrp, that's URTHSTYRPE. And a lot of people have forgotten. They've messaged me about how they're going to tweet about hashtag would be good, but there's no more hashtag would that be good. Michael, what did you learn this week?
I think that just trying to break down sideboarding into like a whole bunch of little nuanced pieces, kind of, it's helpful. But just trying to think about different aspects of sideboarding is helpful for me. I think sometimes a big picture view is helpful, but sometimes trying to break it down into a lot of little things helps me understand my own process better.
Today is one of those episodes where I know these things, and it makes me sad that I feel like I don't have time to do them. Like, I don't know that I learned a ton this week other than that I'm not disciplined enough when it comes to this stuff. And if I want to have drastic improvements in this area, I need to become more disciplined.
I think that that's maybe the hardest thing about sideboarding, that it feels like something you should be able to do in kind of a touchy-feely way. And the more you play, the more realizing that uncertainty in sideboarding is like costing you
just
concrete percentage points.
Just lots
I think
of equity.
It's one of those things that people just don't focus on enough. I think like mulliganing better, like, you know, sequencing better, like any of those things, sideboarding is a skill that you can commit to improving. And like one of the things Matt and I will often do when building a deck is go through and like try to figure out what you would want to cut in every matchup.
Right.
And then sort of try to construct a sideboard from there. But there are a bunch of different ways to construct sideboards, and I think that just, like, being cognizant of why people who are smarter than you are doing what they're doing, trying to, you know, trying to figure out what they're thinking, and just challenging yourself when it comes to sideboarding is really important.
Well, thank you everybody so much for listening. Don't forget to check us out. Patreon, don't forget to check our sponsors at Ink Gaming and Oasis Games. And we'll see you guys all next week.
Magic.